Okay, good. All right. Well, as I walked into class this morning, a couple of you said, I sure hope you're going to talk about the Goldilocks planet. I'll say a few words about that, and then we'll jump into our lesson. And the reason why this has gotten such a big to-do in the press and on TV and, of course, on the web are the comments coming out of the two astronomers that made the discovery, Paul Butler and Steve Vogt. And the two of them are responsible for discovering a large fraction of the now 492 planets that have been found outside of our solar system. But what they announced literally Friday morning was a discovery of the first planet that's in, quote, the Goldilocks zone. And so, and Jim Casing, a famous planetary physicist, a chemist who's also one of the big names in origin of life research, said, this is the first extrasolar planet that I'm truly excited about. But what really generated the buzz were the comments coming from Steve Vogt. And what we have here is that's Steve Vogt coming out of the telescope that he uses. This is the telescope here in California that's been responsible for many of the discoveries. This is the Lick Observatory in the Bay Area. And that's Steve walking out of the dome there with his briefcase. But this is what he said about this Goldilocks planet. It would be shirt-sleeve weather. And, the mean temperature, the average temperature of the planet is 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's what generated all the comments, is that, now that would be assuming that it had an atmosphere exactly like Earth's, then that would be the temperature on the surface. So that's what he said, it would be shirt-sleeve weather. Well, he didn't just say that. He also said that, quote, chances for life on this planet are 100%. So, guaranteed we're going to find life on this planet because of how nice the temperature is on the surface of the planet. And then he also went on to say, it's pretty hard to stop life once you give it the right conditions. So this is what's really generating all the buzz. But what is it that they've really discovered? Now, it is true that this is the first planet they found outside the solar system that would have a surface temperature that would permit liquid water to exist. All the other 491 planets we found, that's not the case. The water would either be frozen or be vaporous or be non-existent. But in this case, we have a planet where the surface temperature would be conducive to liquid water, again with a proviso that it's got an atmosphere just like Earth's. What I want to do is first start off and tell you about the star that this planet orbits about. It's not a star like the Sun. In fact, here's the Sun. And here's the mother star of this planetary system, Gliese 581. And I just saw a big editorial in the LA Times written by a biologist who is complaining about the fact that in astronomy we have all these arcane names for the stars and planets that we find. He said, why don't you do what you do with the asteroids and give them some real names instead of these things like Gliese 581 or HD 101583? I mean, it looks like a license plate. Well, it's true. Almost all the stars that we see in our galaxy have license plate numbers. About 200 have actual names. And those are the 200 that were named by people living, 5,000-6,000 years ago. So stars like Sirius will have a Sirius name, but none of the other ones out there. Now, there's a real this is written by a biologist. The reason why astronomers don't name all the planets is, yes, we only have right now 492 planets outside of our solar system. We could conceivably give them all names just like we name our children. But what's going to happen when we have 40 billion planets? Now you've got a real problem. You don't want to have to assign a name to 40 billion different planets. And that's the estimated number of planets in our Milky Way galaxy. In fact, astronomers are now estimating within 3 years we'll probably have more than 10,000 known planets outside of our solar system. So it's one thing to name the asteroids in the main belt. By the way, the asteroids in the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, which are much bigger than the main belt, we don't give names to all of those. We only give names to the really big ones, literally a handful. All the rest just have these little license plate numbers. So That's why we call it Gliese 581. And what do you call the planets? We call Gliese 581 the star, Gliese 581 A, which means the primary body in the system. A always means a star. B means the first discovered planet. C means the second discovered planet. And what they've got in this case, the Goldilocks planet, is called Gliese 581 G, which means it's the sixth discovered planet in the system. And Gliese 581 ranks as having the most known planets of any body outside of our solar system. But as you can see here, the star is not anything like the sun. In fact, these are the conditions of Gliese 581. It's 20.3 light years away. And so it's got people excited thinking, well, you know, if we really mess up planet Earth, we'll just hop on a spaceship and travel 20 light years out, and we'll have a place where we can set up a colony. A weekend venture, right. Well, it'll take you a long, long time to get there, a lot more than 20 years. That's moving at the velocity of light. And if you pick up our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, the fastest velocity you can go, if cost is no object and technology is no object, only the laws of physics is a restriction, would be 1% the velocity of light, which means you're looking at a minimum 2,000-year journey one way to get to the system. And now this gives you the problem of how do you keep people alive on board a spaceship and their children for 2,000 years, especially when people calculate the maximum longevity for an advanced civilization is only 1,000 years. So that might give you some pause to consider your future investment portfolio. We've had advanced technology since 1945, so that's what we're now 65 years, so that means we got at most maybe about 900 years left before we either go extinct or go back to a Stone Age culture. But that's a problem, so it's really not an option to go to Gliese 581. We better take care of the planet that God gave us. The star is only 3/10 the mass of our star, the Sun, so it's a lot smaller than our star, the Sun. And the luminosity or the brightness of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. So in terms of how bright it is, it's about 1% the brightness of our star, the Sun. So this planet that's in the Goldilocks zone is orbiting very close to its star. It's got to, because the star is just so feeble. And then its age is somewhere between 7 and 11 billion years old. So it's quite a bit older than our star, the Sun. And the problem there is stars, as I've mentioned here before, are like human beings. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle-aged. And this star is sufficiently old that it's going to be spewing out a lot of random high-intensity flares. And by the way, small stars are much more flare-active than stars that are the mass of our sun. One of the advantages of having a planet going about our star is that our star is the best possible mass to minimize flaring episodes. And so we are living, or we're orbiting around the most luminosity stable star that exists in the Milky Way galaxy. Because the star has so little mass, it's not stable enough for any possibility of advanced life. And by the way, Stephen Vogt and Paul Butler acknowledge that. They've said this is definitely not a candidate for advanced life, but it might be a candidate for bacterial life. Because bacteria can handle a lot more radiation and a lot more swings in temperature and ultraviolet radiation than we human beings can. And then as far as its metallicity goes, it has about half the metals that our solar system has. And that's going to be an intriguing point as I get into the conditions of the planets. This is a mystery, why it has so many planets and yet so few elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. Al, you had your hand up first.
Yeah.
It is a red dwarf. Its peak emission is at 8,300 angstroms, which is in the near infrared. So the color you see there really isn't the true color. This would be a very deep red star. So, and that's a problem for life, because even bacterial, photosynthetic bacterial life, needs to have a little bit of ultraviolet radiation constantly coming in to the environment. This star is far too red for that to be a possibility. So you really want a yellow star. Because what these astronomers have calculated is that this star fits into what they call the water habitable zone, that does not fit in the ultraviolet habitable zone. For life to be possible, you need a certain minimum level of ultraviolet radiation, but you don't want too much. I mean, we've been praying for Jackie about her skin cancer. If you have lots of ultraviolet radiation pouring through, then it's going to do a lot of damage to the DNA, and that would even be true of bacteria, not just human beings. And so we have, that's kind of the fallacy in this whole idea about a Goldilocks planet. They only looked at one characteristic that life requires, a temperature that would permit liquid water to be a possibility. And so in addition to a water habitable zone, you've got the ultraviolet habitable zone, and this star is outside the ultraviolet habitable zone. It's pumping most of its radiation out at infrared wavelengths. But you're right. One thing that gets astronomers so excited about this particular find is there's far more red dwarfs in our Milky Way galaxy than stars like the Sun. These stars are about 30 times more numerous, than stars like our Sun. And so, with all the planets that were planning around these kinds of stars, that's what's causing us to say, maybe there are billions of planets in our Milky Way galaxy that are in the Goldilocks zone. Again, the water Goldilocks zone. Well, so those are the main characteristics of Gliese 581, the star. And the whole point here is if you want life, you not only have to have the just right planet, you have to have the just right star. And this is not a just right star. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, because it's relatively small and not too far away, that makes it easier to find planets going around it.
Well, that's why they found all these planets. It is nearby. And so of all the stars we've looked at outside of our solar system, this has got the most planets. So we found one that has 4. We found one that has 5. This one has 6. And the other thing that's remarkable you're going to see in the list is the planets they've all found are small. It's much easier to find big planets than small planets. This system doesn't have any big planets. And yet they've been able to find 6 anyway. But it's because it's so close. Because the star is so close to us, we're able to make these kinds of detections. So I saw a hand in the back. Yes, 2 hands. Go ahead. Yeah, you're first. Go ahead. That goes back thousands of years. And every language, they got a different name for our sun. I think in Spanish, it's Sol. So. So I don't know where sun came from. Probably some German or Norwegian came up with that one. So maybe somebody could dig that up for us. That'd be kind of fun. Okay, 1 light year is 5.9 trillion miles. So this would be 120 trillion miles. 120 trillion. So you can calculate how much gas you would need to drive that distance. Okay, you were next.
I was wondering, how do they know the temperature?
Is that too complex? Oh, no. A temperature of a star is fairly easy to measure. If you know the distance to the star, And you measure its brightness, that tells you how much energy is being pumped out, then you measure its color. And so if you know the color and the brightness, the intrinsic brightness, the actual brightness, not the brightness you see through the telescope, and to get the actual or intrinsic brightness, you need the distance. Well, in this case, they've got an accurate distance, they know the color, they know the brightness, and therefore they can calculate. You have to know the age as well. The age is, the stars will change their surface temperature with respect to age. So now we know the temperature. I think this star, I didn't put it up here, I think its surface temperature comes in at about 3,800 degrees. And if you know the surface temperature of the star and the distance of the planet, then you know how warm it's going to be on the surface of the planet. So that's how they work it all out. Are you ready to see what? Well, you got one more?
Discover a lot more.
Yeah, this one was discovered by a 128-inch telescope just outside San Francisco. So it wasn't anything spectacular, but you don't really need a really big, powerful telescope to do these kinds of measurements. You're basically... Kepler is already up there. In fact, an announcement came out that my colleague Jeff Zwierinka commented about, where they've announced that they have found already 700 planets in addition to the 492 in the catalog. So we know that there's another 700 out there, but they're not in the catalog yet because we haven't got enough time measurements on these 700 planets to know what their characteristics are. We know they exist, but we don't know their characteristics, so they're not yet in the catalog. But they will be probably within a year. So now we're going to have 1,200 planets. And as I said, it won't be long until we have 10,000. Yes?
This is a silly question, but what's the difference between the solar system and the galaxy? Galaxy, is that a larger mass or a larger...
Okay, our Milky Way galaxy is a spiral system of stars that contains a little more than 200 billion stars. And so I wish I had a photo to show you. Well, I probably do. I could probably dig it up here for you of what our Milky Way galaxy looks like. And our star, the Sun, is orbiting not quite halfway out from the center of our galaxy. So our star, every 250 million years, makes one trip around the center of the galaxy, but is only one of 200 billion stars that are doing that. And then our solar system is the system of planets, comets, and asteroids that orbit about our star, the Sun.
Oh, I see. So it's a much smaller...
Yeah. But we're now realizing that, probably anywhere from 2 to 5% of all the stars in our Milky Way galaxy have planets. Those that do have planets tend to have several. So our Milky Way galaxy may contain, say, anywhere from 10% to 50% as many planets as it has stars.
How many galaxies are in the universe?
How many galaxies in the universe? About 250 billion. If you don't count the dwarf galaxies. And there's about 100 dwarf galaxies for every medium or large-sized galaxy. So you want to work it all out. It comes to about 50 to 60 billion trillion stars in the observable universe. But the observable universe is only about 0.1% the size of the actual universe that exists today. That's because the universe we look at is the universe of the past. Takes time for the light to travel. So the universe of today, because of the expanding universe, is actually bigger than the universe we see through the telescopes. But what we see through the telescopes is 50 to 60 billion trillion stars. Yeah, go ahead.
The average temperature might be 70, but couldn't there be a very wide swing depending on what...
There definitely is. That's the problem.
This
shirt-sleeve weather needs to be taken with a grain of salt. Now, here are the characteristics of the six planets. And I didn't put labels on them because I couldn't squeeze them all in. That first column you see there over to the left would be the minimum masses of the six planets as compared to the Earth. So the closest one, and that, by the way, the second column would be the period in days, how many days it takes to go around the star. The third category is how far away the planet is from its star in millions of miles. And then the last column would be the eccentricity, how elliptically shaped the orbit is. All orbits of planets about stars are elliptical. But in the case of our solar system, the eight planets have very close to circular orbits. That's very atypical. The planets that we see, the known planets that we've measured, typically have a large eccentricity. So zero would be a perfect circle. And incidentally, if it's orbiting very close to its star, the gravity of the star will force it into a perfect circle. But once you get past, say, 5 million miles or 4 million miles up from the planet, you notice you're now getting large eccentricities. And that's a problem, because if you've got a planet making a wide swing away from its star, then coming close into its star, that's going to gravitationally disturb other planets in the same system. Now, let me just take this mic. Now I'm free. Okay. The Goldilocks is this one right here. It's a little more than 3 times the mass of the Earth. And by the way, these are minimum masses. They can go from 3 up to infinity. It's 3 if it's perfectly in line with our own planetary system. The period is 37 days, so it takes 37 days to go around its star, and it's 13.5 million miles away from the star, and we don't have an accurate measurement yet of the shape of its orbit. We just don't know. But given the fact that this is highly eccentric, and this one's highly eccentric, we expect that this one likewise will be highly eccentric. And that's important because if a planet has a highly eccentric orbit, it's not a candidate for even primitive life. It's got to have a near circular orbit. Yes?
When you say days, you mean our day or that
planet? We're talking our days. So this would be 37 24-hour days it takes to go around. Now, the reason why that's important, given how close it is to its star, just 13.5 million miles away, and keep in mind that 5 of the planets that you see here are closer to their star than Mercury is to our star. Only one of them is beyond the orbit of Mercury. All the others are orbiting very close to their star. But the fact that it's only 13.5 million miles away means that it's tidally locked. Which means that, and what they've calculated, that what tidally locked means is that the planet maintains the same face to the star permanently. Just like our moon. Our moon is tidally locked to the Earth. So when you look at the moon, it rotates with the same period that it revolves. So it takes 29 days to make a revolution around the Earth, and it rotates with 29 days. Which means that it maintains the same face towards the Earth all the time. And so one side faces the Earth, the other side doesn't. You don't get to see the opposite side. Well, if it's tidally locked to a star, that means one side of the planet is facing the heat of the star and the other side is not. And so the far side of the star, they've calculated, has a temperature of 25 degrees below zero. Now, that would be permanent. So if you're on the opposite side of the star, it's permanently 25 degrees below zero. And if you're on the front side, it's permanently 160 degrees Fahrenheit. And you say, why wouldn't it be a lot hotter if it's permanently facing the star? Well, it's because the star has only 1% the brightness of our star, the sun. So even though it's permanently facing that star, the temperature only goes up to 160 degrees. But, you really can't live at 160 degrees. But what's got the astronomers so excited, if you go to the twilight zone, okay, you get a temperature of 70 degrees. So if you're right on the edge between facing the star and being away from the star, you're in, quote, what's called the Goldilocks zone. Now, it's a relatively small spot, however, because if you go to the poles, it's going to get really cold. You got to be right at the equator, and you got to be at the twilight zone. And so it's a very small spot on the planet that's in the Goldilocks zone. And something that the astronomers did not comment on, if you look at these 6 planets, that spot's not stable. I mean, for example, if you look at our moon, the edge where it's just barely visible to the Earth actually moves. If you look carefully at the moon through a telescope, you'll notice that the twilight zone wobbles back and forth by about 7 degrees. And so we actually see more than half the face of the moon because that you can take advantage of the wobble and actually see about 60% of the surface of the moon rather than just 50%. And the reason why our moon wobbles is that there are other bodies in the solar system that are influencing the gravitational field of the moon. Now, in this system, it's much more dramatic because you've got 6 planets all orbiting fairly close to the star. They're quite close together, a lot closer together than the planets in our solar system. And notice their masses are fairly big. I mean, all of these planets are bigger than the mass of the Earth. And so that little spot on the Gliese 581G is not going to be stable. It's going to be moving around. And given that it's moving around, there's no possibility that even bacterial life could survive it. The spot would have to be stable, but we know from the dynamics of the system, the spot's not stable. Yes?
It seems like every few weeks now we get a report on the plant as well. And it always strikes me as just really in downright dishonest the way that it's publicized. Is that the scientists that are doing that, or is it the press that's just grabbing onto this? I mean, it's always the same story. We have water, we must have light. Or in this case, it's really close to being an earthquake.
No, I don't think these scientists are being deceptive. It's just that they are focusing on an extremely narrow discipline. I mean, I've told the story here in front of the class that when I was an active research fellow at Caltech, lunchtime we would all go to the Burger Continental. It was only a block and a half away from Caltech. And then, we'd all sit at the table. We basically would take over the place at lunchtime, just our astronomy department. But there would be separate tables for the different research groups. There would be a table for the X-ray astronomers, a table for the infrared astronomers, a table for the optical astronomers. I was in the high-frequency radio astronomy group's table, so we sat there. And then two different kinds of theoreticians have their own table. But I can tell you this, if you sat at the wrong table, you could not follow the conversation. So... when you talk to the astronomers at Caltech, when they get the Astrophysical Journal, they read the articles in their narrow sub-discipline and ignore the rest. That's quite typical. I mean, what's unique about the astronomy staff we have had reasons to believe is we actually go through all of them. We're trying to understand the whole sweep of it. But you can't do that if you're spending, 14 hours a day researching your narrow discipline. I was only able to get the kind of interdisciplinary perspective that I have by leaving Caltech.
So you're saying this class knows more about this?
Well, you're getting a broader perspective than, say, what Steve Vogt is getting on this particular... I think that's accurate, Ross. I mean, that's my only explanation for the statement he made, that it's 100% guaranteed that we're going to find life on this planet, and that if you have the right conditions, life will automatically happen. Well, for example, I could conceive of an experiment of a primordial soup, which is basically to take real soup, okay? Take vegetables and meat and water and put salt in it, etc. I mean, that's way better than any possible naturalistic scenario for a primordial soup. And let it sit there for a billion years. We know it's going to happen. You're never going to... Well, you will get bacteria if you don't keep the outside bacteria out. But if you started off in an inorganic environment, after a billion years, it's still going to be just soup. You're not going to get life coming out of it. So, but that's the problem, is that Stephen Vogt, not being aware of what's happening in the frontiers of origin of life research, doesn't realize you need a whole lot more than water on the surface of the planet. And for that matter, I'm not convinced that there is going to be water on the surface of the planet, or at least in the right amounts. As I've been mentioning to the class before, one of the problems we have with these planets we're discovering is they tend to be, if they're Earth-like, they tend to be far too water-rich. I mean, there's two planets that we've discovered so far where we not only know this kind of data, we know the radius and the density of the planet, and what that's telling us is that these planets are 10 to 50% water. And if they're 10 to 50% water, they're definitely not candidates for advanced life. Advanced life requires something between 0.02 and 0.03% water. So one of the miracles of our planet Earth is that it's so incredibly poor in water and also poor in carbon. And see, the problem with a lot of these astrobiologists, Ross, is they assume if you got lots of carbon and lots of water, it's an automatic that you're going to have life. It's actually the other way around. If you've got too much carbon and too much water, then it's off the list as a candidate, at least for advanced life. And so, you know, our planet has 2,400 times less carbon than planets of its size and mass from the sun. But a couple of things I'd like you to see here is that, by the way, we call anything that's less than 10 times the mass of the Earth, yet bigger than the Earth, a super Earth. And this system has, by far the way, the most super Earths. There's five super Earths in this system, and we have one Neptune. So this one's a Neptune-sized planet, and the others are super Earths. But it's something we've been finding is that small stars like Galaxy 581 typically do not produce any Jupiter or Saturn mass planets. And so this is a growing trend. A few of them do, but this is a typical system where it can generate Neptunes, but it can't generate Saturns or Jupiters. In fact, what we're discovering is the more massive the star, the more massive its largest planets. And so given that this star has only 3/10 the mass of our star, the Sun, it's fitting what we're observing elsewhere, namely it doesn't produce any Jupiters or Saturns. Now that's a problem because Jupiter and Saturn play a crucial role in protecting life here on planet Earth. And you know, the thing that troubles me about this system is, look at all the planets we found in it. We're finding too many planets in this system for this to get us all excited about this being a candidate for life. You don't want this many planets. If you've got this many planets, that also means you're going to have a lot of smaller stuff. So I'm predicting, for example, that once we get the technology, we're going to be finding a whole bunch of planets that are Venus-sized and Earth-sized rather than super-Earth-sized, and maybe a whole bunch that are, say, Mercury-sized, all orbiting close to its star, which is going to make it an extremely chaotic system. Which means you're going to probably have a lot of asteroids there too and comets, and you're going to get bombardments all the time. And because there's no Jupiter and Saturn, there's no protection for the planets in the inner part of this planetary system. There's going to be bombardments going on all the time, which means if you've got a little Goldilocks spot on the planet that's moving around, it's also going to be heated up frequently by collision events in that system. So, this is definitely not a Goldilocks planet. On the other hand, I think that within the next 10 years, it wouldn't surprise me if we find 10,000 planets that are, quote, in the Goldilocks zone, which means 10,000 planets plus that would have a surface temperature where liquid water could possibly exist. But again, that assumes that the planet has an atmosphere like Earth's. And what we're discovering so far is that planets the size of the Earth have atmospheres that are at least 10,000 times thicker than our planet Earth. And what that does is it dramatically raises the temperature at the surface of the planet. So it wouldn't surprise me once we get a little more data on this planet that we discover its surface temperature is in the thousands of degrees rather than shirt sleeve weather, 70 degrees. That 70-degree assumption presumes it has an atmosphere just like Earth's. And our atmosphere warms the surface temperature by about 33 degrees. But if we had an atmosphere 10,000 times thicker, then the surface temperature would be hot enough to melt steel. So not a good environment for life. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. The distance between its star and the six planets. So, for example, the most distant one is actually orbiting the star closer than Venus orbits our star.
How is that a permanent distance? If the
yes.
Is irregular, I don't
know. Oh, yeah. Okay, you're right. When it says 20 million miles here, that's the average. Because of how eccentric the orbit is, parts of the orbit will be going out nearly 30 million miles from its star, and other parts is going to be coming in at about 14 million miles. So, yeah, that will vary quite a bit. In the case of our planet Earth, our distance varies by about 2%. So in the wintertime, we're 2% closer to the sun than we are in the summertime. Okay, there is... Yeah. I don't know who's next. I got three hands here. Okay, I'll take you first. Go ahead. Well, it's because they don't know. So they said, since we don't know, let's assume it's just like Earth. And which also explains Stephen Vogt's comment that, let me bring it up here again. Say, where does he come up with this one? It's pretty hard to stop life once you give it the right conditions. Where he got that from is no matter where you go on the Earth, you find life. It's everywhere. So he's assuming anywhere you got conditions like you got on Earth, you're going to have an abundance of life. So that's where that assumption came from. But, I mean, if God wanted to create life here on Earth, then maybe it's got nothing to do. Well, it's got something to do with the right conditions, but that's not all you need to get life going on the planet. And the other thing that I think has been causing some problems for these astrobiologists is we notice that Earth is filled with extremophiles. We see life, you go up to Yellowstone, they have these very acidic ponds, and there's life in there. And, some of these ponds, the temperature's at 160 degrees Fahrenheit. So a lot of these astronomers are saying, maybe you got life on the front side where it's permanently 160 degrees, because after all, we have little pots of water in Yellowstone where it's that hot and bacteria are existing there. Now, the fallacy in that line of reasoning, yes, it's possible that bacteria can survive under those extreme conditions, but it can't originate under those conditions. In fact, there's a paper I've referred to here in class with the title, published in the Astrobiology Journal, interestingly enough, and the title of the paper was Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. Because when you're at 160 degrees, the decay times for the amino acids, the nucleotides, are so extremely short, there's no way anyone can even conceive of a possible assembly of those things into DNA, RNA, and proteins. And if you go down to a really low temperature, like in the backside, because it is true, you go to Antarctica, you will find bacteria living at a little bit under freezing conditions. Not a lot, but just slightly under freezing. And that's because the bacteria have within them antifreeze compounds inside the cell. On the other hand, you can't get a life form to originate under those conditions. It takes mesophilic life, life existing under optimal or ideal conditions, to create the necessary conditions to make possible the existence of extremophiles. But because Stephen Vogt sees life everywhere on the Earth, even under extreme conditions, his belief is, once you get the right conditions, life is automatic. Well, all you need to do is attend one or two Origin of Life research conferences, or pick up our book over here in the Origins of Life, and you'll realize that as smart and as well-funded as chemists are today, they can't make life in the lab. And my colleague Fazrana says, well, if we keep giving them generous funding and keep pushing the technology, the day may come when we can make life in the lab, but it's simply going to testify that you need a lot of intelligence, a lot of knowledge, a lot of funding, and a lot of technology to pull it off, and certainly those conditions did not exist 3.8 billion years ago on the surface of the Earth. Somebody a lot smarter than these chemists, a lot better funded than these chemists, with a lot more technology than these chemists, must have been the one who made life here on planet Earth. Anyway, get the book if you need to be convinced. You're next. You had to tell me you have to turn the switch on and off. So yeah, it's hard to know a broad enough perspective of knowledge to really get a good perspective on this. But what was your comment again?
For the layman, would you say that science news does a better job than the press?
Yeah, and Science News is a magazine I do recommend. It comes out weekly. And it's written by scientists who read the actual peer review papers and interview the researchers. And it's definitely less biased than Scientific American, definitely less biased than the Discovery magazine. They try to take a neutral stance. But if you really want to get the goods, you have to read the actual papers that are published in the peer review letters. Sometimes, I mean, you know, this isn't easy stuff to do.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, for example, to try to get the right perspective in the origin of life, you really do need to read, say, all the papers that have been published on that subject over the last 20 years, attend some of the conferences, read the books, and then you kind of get a perspective on it. I mean, it was really illuminating when I went to the first Origin of Life research conference I'd ever attended in 1999. And, you know, as soon as I walked into the auditorium, it was a shock to me because, you know, I've been to a number of astronomy meetings. And when you walk into an astronomy conference, there's just this tremendous atmosphere of excitement at the beginning of the conference. Everybody's excited about the research papers they're going to be presenting and all that we're learning, all the new discoveries we're making. And as Fuzz and I walked into that Origin of Life research conference back in 1999, the atmosphere was one of utter despair and gloom and pessimism because they weren't making any of the discoveries that they had expected, and they were discovering that their quest to find a naturalistic answer to the origin of life was far more remote than it was 50 years ago when the discipline got started. So it's a classic example where the discipline is going backwards rather than forwards. Although I would say, we got to hear a lot of papers on some amazing chemistry achievements in the lab, but I remember one atheist Origin of Life researcher standing up and saying, you know, this is incredible chemistry. I'm impressed with what you guys have done, but all of this is irrelevant to the origin of life. Because, you know, all the stuff you're doing in the lab, we know was not the case for the surface of the Earth 3.8 billion years ago. And he says, you guys keep pushing this, all you're going to do is convince everybody it's intelligent design. You know, that was a comment coming out from an atheist Origin of Life researcher. And I remember the guy who gave the first lecture, Leslie Orgel, who is the leading light in Origin of Life. He's now passed away. I remember the first comment he made in his plenary lecture, the very first lecture given at the conference. He said, I hope there are no creationists in the audience from what I'm going to say, that the origin of RNA would take a miracle. So, and, you know, there were two creations in the audience. I wrote down what he said word for word, and I've quoted him a number of times. So, yes. Well, you know what? Everybody knew who we were. We had reasons to believe right on our little name tag. And by the way, we were very well received. You know, they basically said, as long as you guys are old Earth, as long as you guys are faithfully recording, you know, what's actually going on, and it says, we don't mind. In fact, our book, Origins of Life, has gotten a very nice endorsement from one of the leading atheist Origin of Life researchers, and basically said our book is the most complete in terms of covering all the disciplines on the origin of life. He says, I don't like the Jesus Christ part, but I do like the fact that this is a complete and up-to-date survey of the status of the discipline.
What I wanted to say, though, is that your idea of needing to take into account all of the points of view from all of the papers is very much like what you've been telling us, that we need to take into account all of the creation events in the Bible in order to properly.
Right. Yep, same principle. You got to look at all the creation texts in the Bible. Don't just look at Genesis 1. You know, I believe that all the creation disputes in the church would largely melt away if people would integrate through the 66 books of the Bible. It's the focus on just one narrow discipline. So, yeah, let's not just throw stones at these astrobiologists for being too narrowly focused. The same principle applies to those of us in the church if all we look at is one particular creation text, or consider that one creation text is superior to all the others. Yes.
I watch the History Channel a lot and the Discovery Channel. Do you think they're biased, or are they? Can you take those things with a grain of salt, or do they say?
Well, I'm particularly skeptical of the History Channel, because I've been on that channel a few times, and what they've done with my interview, in my opinion, was pretty appalling. And, oh boy, did they ever. They made it look like, well, I got interviewed, for example, about UFOs, and they actually painted me as believing the opposite of what I believed. And basically what they did, they came into my office and interviewed me for 45 or 50 minutes, took one 11-second clip out of what I said and a 15-second clip and made it look like I believed the opposite of what I actually believed. Well, I called the History Channel and they said, well, it wasn't with us. We contracted that out. And so they got a different company to do it for them. And, they said, look, you signed a release saying we could use anything in the material you wanted. And so there's actually no legal recourse. For in fact, another fellow on the same program was interviewed. And what they did is they clipped out the word not from his statement. I kid you not. They did that to him three times.
Developing the canon, whatever you call it, the gospel according to Judas,
right?
Things like that. So now you were saying take everything into consideration. They have to edit certain things out and say, well, look, this doesn't fit in our pattern. Let's take it out. But what about those type of books where the gospel according to Judas? They say that Jesus told Judas, you have to betray me. This is part of the prophecy.
Well, you know, the church over the last 2,000 years has been critically looking at what are called the extra-canonical books. And there are extra-canonical New Testament books and extra-canonical Old Testament books. There is a consensus in the Christian community that none of the New Testament extra-canonical books has any credibility. And so there's a unanimous opinion that these all need to be rejected. Why? Because they're written far later than, it couldn't have been written by Judas, because we got evidence saying that they were written much later than that.
150 years later, maybe 200.
Well, they're thinking even later than that. There's a whole number of Gospels that are out there. And the whole point is, it only goes in the canon if it's written by the actual author that was an eyewitness to the events. Or was in dialogue with eyewitness. Luke wasn't an eyewitness to the resurrection, but he carefully interviewed the eyewitnesses who were. And so in the case of the four Gospels we see in the New Testament, they were written at the time that the authors were alive. And also what we see is within the Gospels that there are marks of supernatural inspiration, where you can see that the authors were writing about things they themselves did not understand, that there was no attempt to deceive. What we also see is that they weren't just picking out the cherries. What I mean by that is typical of extra-canonical books is it's kind of like the Egyptian pharaohs. They'd only write about their victories but not their defeats. And so what you see in the Bible is that you get an unvarnished record. Abraham, for example, you see all of his flaws as well as his good traits. That's true. And likewise, when Matthew writes, he writes of his own flaws. So he's not trying to hide anything. And moreover, there's a predictive element. What you see in the 66 books of the Bible, they're all predicting future scientific discoveries and future historical events, which the test of time tells us really did come true. Moses laid down this standard, for example, of what belongs in the canon. He says, God will send you many prophets after me, but there will be many false prophets. And here's how you tell the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet. A false prophet will either contradict the law that you have just received or will predict future events that don't come true. And he said, if one of their predictions fails to come true, not just, 10%, but he says, if one fails to come true, that's a false prophet. And at that time, the penalty for being a false prophet was to be stoned to death.
Now, didn't Jesus contradict, when the adulteress was being stoned. Wasn't that part of the Old Testament law? Stoned an adulteress, but then he said, "You who haven't sinned, cast the first stone." Is that a contradiction?
Well, what Jesus was doing was exposing their hypocrisy. Jesus was exposing their hypocrisy. He says, you know what? Adultery's happening. You're asking me to exercise the penalty that's there in the Old Testament, but you've never done this yourself. And moreover, what you see in the Old Testament law is that these penalties were put into place for the government to exercise, not the individual. The Old Testament is very clear. Only the governing authorities have the right to this kind of justice. Moreover, it's a maximum penalty. It's not a required penalty.
Maximum
penalty. In other words, you can only deliver retribution up to this particular limit. One of the things the Mosaic Law points out, for example, if a father commits murder, his son cannot be held accountable. Only the one who does the murder can be held accountable. And in order to restrain the expression of murder, you can use a death penalty. If that's what it takes to bring murder under control, you can go that far, but no further. But there was always the opportunity for the judges to show mercy. And so, you know, Jesus was simply exposing their, you know, two-facedness on this issue. And he's basically said, you know, you who are without sin, cast the first stone. And they all walked away. Yeah, go ahead.
The Shroud of Turin. This is supposed to be the cloth that Jesus was clothed in. This is supposed to be the most examined article, I guess, in history. And I've watched the History Channel, the Discovery Channel. When you look at the cloth, do you see Jesus' face? Or is it when you take a picture of it, you see Jesus?
Well, again, watch what you... Be careful not to believe everything you see on the History Channel, okay? There's stuff on the Shroud that gives me a lot of pause, too. Personally, I'm a skeptic on the Shroud of Turin. And the reason why I'm a skeptic is, you know, people I know at JPL carbon-dated the thing. And they got a date of the 13th century A.D.
Right, but they also said that the carbon dating could be off even 1,000 years because they've carbon-dated recent things that have been...
Well, they're on to something. Carbon dating is based on carbon, you know, nitrogen decaying into carbon-14, or carbon-14 decaying, pardon me, and it's produced by cosmic rays impinging on nitrogen. The half-life is 5,715 years. And here's a rule of thumb in radiometric dating. You can trust it if the date you come up with is a factor of 6, higher or lower or less than the half-life. And 13th century A.D. puts it outside the reliable range. But, you know, even if you were to put that 1,000-year error bar in, it still wouldn't make it the cloth that Jesus was buried in. That would only be 4th century A.D. And there's lots of evidence that Jesus of Nazareth lived about 400 years previous to that. So what the scientists at JPL were able to say is, look, we know it wasn't the shroud that Jesus was buried in, because our carbon-14 date eliminates that possibility. Now, what the people who are saying maybe it's a real item said, well, maybe you took the 4 square inches from the wrong piece of the shroud. And so they were saying maybe parts of the shroud are older than other parts.
Right.
JPL's response was this, well, give us another piece. Yeah. We'll test it again. Well, let me finish. Another reason that I am skeptical is they found dyes in the shroud that weren't invented until the 13th century A.D. And since that matches the best carbon-14 date, it gives me cause that maybe this was a fraudulent production. And the only thing I know about the 13th century, that is the century where we saw the greatest marketing of relics of the crucifixion of Jesus. That's also a century in which people sold 16 tons of wood from the cross that Jesus was crucified on. Now, chances are the cross did not weigh 16 tons.
That's why he had to have help.
But what the biblical text tells, only one guy carried it. Well, what really gives me some pause on this is that the forgery is so good, I don't doubt the fact that they may have crucified someone to death in order to make the forgery as high quality as it is. That's a possibility. But given the context, what was going on in the 13th century AD, I don't put that beyond them. They may have actually done that, because after all, the market for these relics was so high. That was also a time when they were selling thousands of gallons of the water that had been in the cup that Jesus had drank from.
But still, is it a picture, is it a painting of his face, or is it an actual, they say that there was radiation or something, the lightning hit his body, and that's what made the imprint on the cloth, so I'm still trying to figure out the
Okay, let me bring this to the close. I mean, there's a number of amazing things in the shroud. That tell me, you know, these people worked really hard to try to make this thing look as authentic as possible. As this, you know, because they got the holes in the right places in the wrist and the feet. Everything was done very precisely, which leads me to believe they must have done some experiments to get it as good as they did, and really tried to make it look like there was some photo imprintation going on. So I said, this is a very well done and well financed fraud. Now, in terms of apologetics, if this thing was genuine, would it significantly add to the evidence we have that Jesus was alive at the time, was crucified unto death, and rose bodily from the dead? The answer is no, it doesn't add one bit. No. I'm far more impressed with the empty tomb evidence than I am any kind of shroud. Now, what does impress, and one thing I don't like about the shroud, what it tells us in the book of John and Luke, is that two of the disciples walked into the tomb, and as soon as they saw the shroud and the headpiece, they immediately believed that Jesus had bodily resurrected from the dead. Now, the reason is because of a detail you see in the Gospel of John, where it says that he was given a rich man's burial, and he was wrapped in linen cloth, and the linen cloth was soaked with a minimum of 75 pounds of fragrant rosins. Now, those rosins we now know are kind of equivalent to when you put a glass thing on a boat, fiberglassing. In other words, what Peter and John saw when they walked into the empty tomb was a body cast, 75 pounds plus hardened linen body cast, just like fiberglass. And there was no breaks or cuts in it, and yet the body was not there. And so as they looked at that, they said the only possible explanation is that he supernaturally and bodily rose through that barrier and on up into heaven. And then a few days later, they saw the resurrected Christ come back. But, you know, that evidence to me is far more impressive than any kind of shroud. And the problem with the shroud is, where are the rosins? So, I mean, because the text tells us, 75 pounds plus the rosins went into that. Okay, we're a little bit out of time on this. By the way, we've written on the Shroud of Turin on my website. I've gotten a lot of flack for what I've written on the website because people are claiming it's a genuine article and aren't very appreciative of some of the comments I've made, but you can take a look at it. And by the way, if you're still a skeptic, all we need to do is convince the people who own the Shroud to give JPL a square foot instead of 4 square inches, and then we can rule this thing out once and for all. So, anyway, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the amazing time in which we live, and that we can put these things to the test. We can put to the test what we see going on with stars outside of our solar system and planets outside of our solar system. Lord, we praise you that you've given astronomers the capacity to see your handiwork and your miraculous interventions in a way we've never been able to see before. And we look forward to discoveries that will be coming our way within the next year or two that will provide us with even stronger evidence than we have today. We thank you, too, Lord, that you've left historical evidence and scientific evidence of the truth of the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead, that we can know beyond any reasonable shadow of doubt that indeed there was this man, the creator of the universe, that came to Earth and gave us this example of humility that we can follow, but also through his death on the cross and his bodily resurrection has demonstrated that he is the power to give life where we have death and to transfer his righteousness for our moral failures. So, Father, we thank you for that offer, and Lord, we pray that you would give us many opportunities to present that offer to people that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.
Read your new book, and on the multidimensional, what I get